Hello everyone, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger for naturalnews.com. And today, I have a special treat for all of you. You're going to want to listen to this. I am sitting next to Dr. Brian O'Leary in southern Ecuador. Thanks for joining us today, Brian.
Well, glad to be here, Mike.
Now, for those of you who may not know, and I can't imagine you not knowing, because Brian has been so active in the community. He's been involved in new science. He's a physicist. He's actually an astronaut. He is one of the progressive thinkers in solving the problems of our civilization, our world. And now living in southern Ecuador, you've been here for 3 years now, right?
Yes, and I must admit that 5 years ago I would never have dreamt or fathomed that Meredith and I would be here. But we're here, and maybe for similar reasons why you're here. It's such a relief and pleasure and complete joy to be here and away from the I can't even think of the word to describe it, the bedlam, the chaos, the dumbed downness of our wonderful land up north, and how it's been so taken over by forces that seem to be right now invincible, but which have kind of put the screws on all of civilization by pursuing a path toward the destruction of our natural environment.
We see a real consistency in their actions. These people that you're talking about, these forces, they seem to be interested in extracting as much as possible from not only the planet, but also the people. And as much of your research has led to, they're actually blocking the solutions that we need.
Absolutely.
To create freedom, to create sustainable life on this planet. Can you speak to, well, you talk about new energy a lot. Can you talk about what's happening in energy now?
Well, in the energy question, and I, by the way, I have a long background in this, so it's not like I'm just a voice in the wilderness coming from the outside. My PhD work, although it was in atmospheric physics, which also, of course, well qualifies me to vet the global climate change, greenhouse effect, global warming situation, and CO2 concentrations going up. But it also qualified me to branch into the energy field relatively early in my career. When I was, I was Morris Udall's energy advisor when he ran for president in 1975. He was actually from Tucson, Arizona, and I was his right-hand man, basically his chief speech writer, senior advisor for his subcommittee on energy and the environment. And at that time, the issue before us was nuclear power. Our committee single-handedly stopped that, which I felt very proud to be a part of that effort, short-lived as it was. And around that time, there was a perception that the environmental movement was robust and really had a future. And we were also very concerned about the overuse of fossil fuels, of hydrocarbons, oil, coal, and natural gas, and that we needed to push alternatives. And so at that time, the perception was, and my perception was, well, let's look at solar and wind, and let's check out biofuels and hydrogen. Let's look at this huge possibility of conventional renewable energy sources. And at that time, having just held a couple of positions, one at the University of California, Berkeley Law School on technology assessment, this was a graduate course for law students and also for graduate students in the sciences and engineering to assess emerging technologies and be able to make a really honest appraisal without the kind of biases that we now see in so-called government reports and so forth. So at that time, there was a real feeling of optimism, of enlightenment. We were able to successfully stop the war in Vietnam. The political atmosphere seemed conducive to doing this kind of thing. And in terms of my own career, it was very easy for me to take a step sideways from astronomy and physics and space science and get into the energy field. And then I went to Hampshire College. I was a professor of science policy assessment. And at that point, I really got into energy. And I began to figure out that if we went on the way we've been going on, that by around the year 2000, we'd be well on our way to runaway global warming and a number of other things. So I was already aware of those things then.
And this was in the 70s,
you were saying. 1972, 73, 75. That was then. And so my interest then branched out. I was looking for visionary solutions to the energy problem. I'd look at everything. I'd look at things like solar power satellites that would collect solar energy in orbit where the sun shines all the time, and then microwave beam the energy down to receiving antennas on the Earth. I looked at that. I looked at many things, but I began to slowly come to the conclusion that none of the above was really going to work. Even solar and wind, as promising as they were, they're both materials intensive. If you look at the full life cycle environmental cost of each of these options, I began to throw up my hands, saying, well, these alternatives are one heck of a lot better than the hydrocarbons or nuclear power, but they still had their own problems. When you examined, well, what do you do, you know, how do you get all these materials, and how do you manage an energy picture? On the other hand, the decentralized aspect of it was very appealing, and so I kind of came to the conclusion a long time ago that if nothing else comes along, then by default, we could go kind of tighten our belts, so to speak, and have a blend of energy efficiency and solar and wind and sources like that.
But you did find many other things.
Well, then that was later. In the late 1980s, I went on a personal metaphysical journey, a spiritual journey, if you will, when I started to have some unusual personal experiences that were not agreed to by my colleagues. So here,
that's very politely stated.
Here I was in the physics department at Princeton, and on the faculty there were 40 of us. We were all men. Six of us were Nobel laureates. And around that time, I started to take transformational workshops. I took a LifeSpring training. I began to get into a metaphysical exploration, and what I found was that I had various psychic experiences I couldn't explain by the materialistic Western science that I was teaching. I had a near-death experience, and this kind of cracked open my cosmic egg, and I had to quit Princeton because none of my colleagues went for this at all. They thought I was crazy. I had to stay in the closet. And so at around 1982, when I had my near-death experience in an auto accident, a very poignant experience in my life in which I came into the light, I was given up for dead, and I came back to life. And that really kind of showed the way for me. And that and remote viewing experiences and various healing experiences, I began to realize that Eastern thought had a lot more interesting things to investigate than this materialistic, reductionistic Western model of reality. And so, in a way, it was very, very difficult for me. This is when I was in my early 40s, because I had two children that were about to go to college. I needed to fund their college education, and I was between a rock and a hard place, between walking the straight and narrow career path on the one hand, and on the other hand, understanding that our reality was much more magnificent than we had ever thought. And so my route into the new energy technologies, and I'll explain that in a minute, was sideways. It was kind of in the back door, if you will. I began to study the UFO phenomenon. I wondered about technology transfer. I investigated the questions of, as a physicist, of quantum theory and how it created all of these paradoxes of materialism, non-materialism, the phenomena of consciousness, the instantaneous transfer of information beyond the speed of light, which kind of liberated me from this very straitjacket thinking. So that's how I got into the new energy game. And I began to realize, having read theoretical papers and done my own research, and now we get into the late 80s, that in principle, it was possible to have energy sources which were clean, cheap, decentralized, and could solve the global warming problem, could solve the air pollution problem in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, this is worth pursuing. So I looked at the works of Nikola Tesla. I began to understand from the point of view of physics how Faraday in the 1830s discovered that energy could be created from a wheel containing magnets interacting with this hypothesized zero-point energy field or the energy from the vacuum. And then I said, well, I really have to see this for myself. So I convened through the an organization that I was co-founder of called the International Association for New Science. I convened with my colleagues a number of free energy inventors from and they flew in from all over the world. And there was a software billionaire that was almost going to fund them. And we were hoping that all of this would work. It didn't, because his marketing people said, no, you don't want to throw good money after bad. Let somebody else do the research, and then I'll enter when the profits go up the steepest, right, the river of optimized profits. So a little later, after all of those meetings and having met these people, I did a couple of world tours of free energy inventors, and I looked at a whole range of devices. Based upon that trip, it was a photojournalistic investigation of these alleged free energy concepts. I came to the conclusion that the technologies are very real. There are many technologies. And it was around that time also I met the late Eugene Malov, editor of Infinite Energy magazine, who was working on cold fusion or low energy nuclear reactions. And so my conclusion was that there are many technologies. They're at the research phase of a research and development cycle. But then also that they've all been suppressed by one means or another.
Could you speak for a moment to the whole suppression of Fleischmann and Pons and what happened? I mean, their announcement was just blasted by the hot fusion people.
Absolutely. What happened there was, in 1989, two University of Utah chemists, Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons, came up with a discovery that when a certain palladium alloy cathode was dipped into a heavy water solution, there seemed to occur nuclear reactions that produced no radiation but produced excess thermal energy. And there were, meanwhile, groups of scientists that were already well-funded by the federal government to create large tokamak central station nuclear fusion, hot fusion reactions in these enormous toroidal shaped structures that tried to confine a magnetic field.
And still don't work, by the way.
They don't work. They don't work, and it's been tens of billions of dollars now spent. And those same hot fusion scientists, many of whom were at MIT at the time, were trying to replicate the Pons-Fleischmann work. Well, first of all, these guys were not qualified to do that. They were, they're not electrochemists. They don't do benchtop experiments. They think big. They get big funding. They're very influential at MIT, Department of Energy, and so forth. So the chief science writer at that time, Eugene Malov at MIT, decided that he was going to kind of prove that cold fusion was a fraud and that these Pons and Fleischmann were just a bunch of, just a bunch of crap. And so he looked at the data and he found just in reverse that the Pons-Fleischmann work and many replications since then were very real proofs of concept, and that in fact the nuclear hot fusion physicists at MIT committed fraud in fudging their data and showing that it didn't work. And it's an example, as Arthur C. Clarke, one time said, the great science fiction writer, this could be the greatest scientific scandal of all time.
And it's important, I think, for those listening to know that this is a classic example of a political decision overriding science. Because it was really the politics of those hot fusion people to protect their egos, to protect their research and their funding. I mean, if you could create energy on a tabletop, why do you need the billion-dollar hot fusion reactors?
Absolutely. And now, of course, now people are becoming more and more aware of this, thanks to the egregious performance of the Bush administration in censoring so many scientific breakthroughs and defending a point of view that can only help big oil, big industry. And of course, we know this is across the board, whether it's in the field of health or whatever it is, and it's happened in spades as well in the energy field. And so there are various levels of perception. Unfortunately, the progressives and the mainstream Democrats seem to stop short of understanding the solutions. They go so far as to critique the censorship itself, for example, the censorship of climate change attributable to human intervention, the environment, that sort of thing. Yeah, that's now very clearly understood, thanks to the consensus of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and a number of other scientists who work for NASA, James Hansen, people that I've done a lot of research with myself, and to know that, of course, the human caused climate change is a very real thing, but they stop short when it comes to solutions.
I'd like to ask you, Brian, or do you prefer that I call you Dr. Leary, or what?
Oh, Brian's fine. Yeah, either way.
Well, I'd like to ask you to respond to this question. I think many people who live in the United States today are under the impression that the Democrats are fully aware of all the solutions to this and they're going to solve it, that we're going to build solar factories and wind farms, and we're going to solve this problem before peak oil really kicks in and we run out of oil. And besides, we might discover the gas hydrates from the ocean or something else. It's all going to be solved. It couldn't possibly be true that some revolutionary solution is being overlooked. I think that's a common belief.
Yeah.
What would you say to those people who bring that kind of thinking to the present here?
Well, there are so many people that think that way, Mike, that I've been fighting these battles now for close to 30 years, and in the energy question especially, and it seems as though the more severe the problem, the more gripping it is, the further away people perceive the solution. Mm. It's what led the great philosopher Bertrand Russell to say the resistance to a new idea increases as the square of its importance.
Ah, I love that quote. Yes.
So if we're talking about supplanting a multi-trillion-dollar per year industry, namely the oil, coal, mainstream industrial vested interest in it's like the pharmaceutical game or the insurance companies. They have so taken over and they have such a stranglehold on energy policy that what happens is that the loyal opposition, the Democrats, the progressives, are kind of set up to say, well, now, wait a minute, we have answers. We have solar, we have wind, we have the hydrates in the ocean, we have this and this, the biofuels. But then upon any critical examination, you find that none of those can really replace what is now being delivered by fossil fuels and nuclear power. So you're caught in this conundrum of credibility, because you have a censorship going on, a suppression going on by an unwitting alliance between all politicians, almost all mainstream scientists whose bread is buttered by establishment funding, mm-hmm. almost all nonprofits and foundations who are fed at the same trough, and of course the media. And the media has totally blacked this out, and I'll give you a little story. I was invited about a year ago to appear on a BBC special, television special. They were going to send out a crew to the whole thing on new energy, what I call new energy, which includes cold fusion, zero-point energy, vacuum energy, sonoluminescence, advanced hydrogen chemistries, the breakthrough stuff, the stuff that could really solve the global warming problem. Okay? And they a producer called me and invited me onto the show. So I said, well, fine, sure, let's do it. And when we were just about to set up a date for this to happen, I didn't hear from him for the longest time. So I emailed him. We were emailing back and forth. And I said, well, you know, are we doing this or what? And he said, no, the executive producer decided to limit this only to hot nuclear fusion.
Aha.
And that's the BBC. The censorship in the media is basically complete.
Well, the BBC has now abandoned any honest reporting on alternative medicine or natural remedies. They've, in fact, they've removed everything about herbs and Chinese medicine from their website. They've said, we're now going completely mainstream, conventional pharmaceuticals. That's all they're going to report. So it's quite a parallel. I mean, it's no surprise. Yes.
No surprise. It's the suppression is complete. Boy, these guys really know how to suppress. They know how to keep a secret. And if you really look I gave you the sources of suppression, which is just virtually every element of mainstream Western culture has put the lid on any of this. And people find it very hard to believe.
They do.
And of course, that's the problem, is whenever I try to break through to somebody, and I have a colleague here in town, his name is Keith Lamp, he does an email newsletter, and he's kind of, he's like the bad cop. He's a bad cop, I'm a good cop. What he does is he tries to take so-called activist groups and NGOs and say, these people are at the feeding trough. They don't really want to solve these problems. When we really know that we can have second generation renewable energy or herbal remedies to a whole bunch of problems, it's just not happening because of this unwitting alliance between the so-called environmental, health-conscious, liberal, progressive, academic, you know, whatever, NGO, nonprofit. They're all singing together, and the song they're singing is, yeah, we got a problem, but we don't really have a solution.
And they are still always part of the status quo, and I don't recall who said this, but I love this quote, innovation is the enemy of the status quo.
Yes.
And it seems like they can accept small incremental changes in philosophies, but they're never willing to accept a revolutionary idea.
Exactly.
And it's like that book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
Yes.
Where, you know, the old guard has to either retire or die before the new idea can even be allowed a voice, a forum.
Absolutely. And by the way, that's a classic, the Kuhn book. It's called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he defines the term paradigm or worldview, in which when it comes to paradigms, scientists are probably about as unscientific as you can get.
Yeah, we see that all the time in medicine.
They hide out in their own cul-de-sacs of reality. And unfortunately, the mainstream culture, the people that really do want to change, they don't understand it. There's no communication. One of the reasons I moved to Ecuador is to get away from all that, because it was infested. And, you know, in my speeches that I give, I'd get invited to give a talk somewhere, and five people would show up. Well, why five people? Because this guy's talking about far out stuff. He's gone off the deep end. He's no longer a scientist, because some of his former colleagues said so.
Right.
He's off. Yeah, he's crazy. He's one of those. What the word for it is? And it's been so frustrating. But at least I'm used to it, because I've been at this for now 20 plus years of being explicitly outside of the box of normal Western scientific thinking, and Now I'm comfortable enough with it because now my kids are in and out of college. They're on their own now. And you can kind of see this dichotomy between the pressure on people to take a career path and raise kids and stay conventional.
Yes.
And stepping outside the box. I inhabited both worlds for a while for out of financial necessity. And,
right.
And then finally when, you know, I'm now, well, I'm 68, so I'm finally of an age and I get a modest social security check and that's all we need to live on here in Ecuador. And whatever else comes in, whether we sell Meritus art or my books or whatever, it'll go right into our project here.
And I do want to mention, excuse me, the good news that's happened in the last few years in terms of the internet now being the place for people to go who want to actually be informed about what's really happening in this world. I think our readers and our listeners are great examples of this, but there are many others who read, you know, Organic Consumers Association or Common Dreams or other websites. These people understand that mainstream media is pure entertainment. It has no credibility. It's never reporting the truth. It's entirely corporate speak, and that the place to get accurate and honest information about what's happening in the world, including solutions, is the internet.
Absolutely.
The internet is decentralized. It's very much open source. It's very free. And many of the people doing what they're doing, like myself, are doing it on a largely volunteer basis. And as a result, there's an attitude of sharing. And now, like in free energy, they can't just come in and assassinate a free energy guy anymore because, like, not the way they used to, because he or she has channels through the internet to make those inventions known.
Well, I totally agree with you. I think that except for one small thing, which is very sad, is that free energy inventors are still getting assassinated, yeah, right up until now. And it's in part because when they get close to the point of commercialization, then they're usually bumped off. Mm. And I have many, many stories of that. I'd say there are now, I can count maybe 25 free energy inventors or promoters when they get very close to the point of getting funding for their work, then they're bumped off. The most recent was an inventor of a special battery, a special new energy type battery, and he was about to get on a plane in Charlotte, North Carolina. I forget his name now. And this was just about 3 months ago.
Oh, really?
And he was found slumped over dead on a steering wheel in the long-term parking lot. Well, it's very clear. Somebody bumped him off, and then he was... now, of course, the police report will always say natural causes.
Of course, yeah.
But that happens all the time. I wish that this didn't happen anymore. And, you know, if I have anything to urge your readers, or listeners, is that you really... We need help. We can't... A small number of people can't do this, even though it can make a big difference.
Yeah.
If those people are bumped off.
Right.
Gene Malov was brutally murdered. The fellow at MIT, he was a real, he was one of my heroes. He was a editor of Infinite Energy magazine and a real organizer and advocate of cold fusion and other advanced energy technologies. And Gene was going to keynote a conference that some of us put together, and 3 months before the conference, he was murdered. The cover story was a robbery, but that's ridiculous.
So then
I was the keynote speaker.
Right.
And I got the hell out of the country fast after that. But this is one of the things people have to understand, is that it's so easy to be bumped off and have it look like something else.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and we'll leave it to people to imagine what groups might be behind that. But basically, it's easy to answer that question. Who has a financial stake in protecting the status quo?
Well, there's the CIA. There are so many war stories. I have a few. I'd rather not share them at the moment because I want to live. But many of us have war stories. Many of us have tried to be murdered. And this goes on. I'm so sorry to say, but it does happen.
But now, what would be required for there to be a breakthrough commercialization or even widespread proof of concept of a free energy device? What has to go into place now? Is there a way that the internet can make this happen, can help an inventor get it out there and get it open source or something like that?
That's a very good question. Open sourcing is an idea some of us have had to make it happen. And there have been a few inventors that have actually, without going through the patent process, have already published their designs on the internet. But here's the problem. There seems to be a gap between inventors who can prove a concept, prove a scientific principle, and the actual commercial prototyping. The gap is huge, much bigger than most people realize. There's a lot of engineering involved, a lot of teamwork, and you know, in a better world, what you need is an Apollo program for breakthrough energy, and to have it managed responsibly so it's not confiscated. Because you see, what happens is, in many cases, the U.S. Department of Defense will confiscate a device under the secrecy rule 35, yes, and tell an inventor never to work on it again. That is if the inventor is lucky and is not murdered first. And so you have all of these scenarios of suppression. So how do you get around that? I'm going to use the R word, revolution.
Yeah.
The powers that be need to be unseated from power. Yes, there's a possibility that quietly and locally different people can develop it. There are examples of that. There's a town in Switzerland that's isolated itself from the rest of the world.
Oh, yes, and they have Linden. Seen photos of their device, but they refuse to share the technology.
They refuse to share it because they think it can be abused, and I agree. I think it could be abused, and that's why I say, well, there has to be social change.
Yes.
And that gets to the nub of it, not technological. The technologies are there, the plan to enable these technologies to come forward. It's all there. It's just that human institutions that are dominant right now have become so sick and so greedy that they have to be overturned.
Yes. Well, this is one of the key questions I wanted to ask you. What you just alluded to is, if we have free energy or very, very inexpensive clean energy, you know, too cheap to meter, as they used to say with hot fusion.
Right.
But if we have such a breakthrough like that, without social change, without the teaching of ethics, without a new mindset of responsibility, then isn't it possible that it would simply unleash a massive population bubble that would cause even more serious harm to the Earth? Not, you know,
it's all possible, and you know, this is the kind of discussion that needs to be held, a free and open discussion of the pros and cons.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why, and by the way, and we'll talk about it in a minute, we're creating a retreat center here to be able to freely discuss some of these issues, because I'm not necessarily an advocate of going lickety-split into a free energy economy or culture. I think that it has to be responsibly managed, that the people will need to align in ways that they never have before to develop a social policy that would allow the implementation of some of these technologies to be safe and harmonious for all of man and nature. And if that purpose is neglected, and if it becomes yet just another corporate entity or control mechanism, then I say no. That's why these kinds of discussions need to be held. Yeah. But you see, right now, the culture, such as it is, will not even allow these discussions to happen.
Exactly. It's the censorship of the very idea.
I'd love to, you know, there's one very famous economist who I finally got a comment out of her I said, well, what would you feel that, let's say hypothetically, even if you didn't believe me, that such a thing could come along, that we would have free energy? What would you think? Do you think this is a good idea? How could we make the economic conversion to make it happen if you think it's reasonable? And her answer was, we don't want more, and then everybody would have a personal helicopter and we'd really be, you know, and we are raping the earth. And of course, that's the essence of what we're getting at here, is that whenever anybody discusses solutions, then you have to dig even deeper. And you realize that this is not only about technology, it's probably even more so about how can humans become responsible stewards of the earth, and are we going to be able to save things in spite of ourselves? And for that, of course, we need revolutionary social structures, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and nothing less.
Mm. I've often thought on this topic that, let's say that oil were 10 cents a barrel instead of $100 a barrel, what would be the effect? But yet we obviously need to replace the dirty, polluting energy source with something that is clean. But yes, how do we do so responsibly? Otherwise, these hillsides that surround you right here, all of those of you listening can't see this, obviously, but we are in an incredibly beautiful mountainous region that is green and full of clean water and fresh air and sunshine. It is a pristine environment. What would happen if energy were free and not constrained by personal responsibility or organizational responsibility to preserving nature?
And there has to be that responsibility. That responsibility must be our number one priority in the world, regardless of what energy sources we use.
Yes.
Regardless of what, I mean, these kinds of choices, there is a social element of it. And although, yes, our energy sources, our food sources, could be more decentralized and should be, but there also needs to be a social organization that makes that so. Mm. And in order for that to happen, that's where the rubber meets the road. These are the kinds of issues we're going to be discussing here in the peace and quiet and tranquility of Montes Sueños, which is the retreat center.
Can you give the website address?
Yeah, okay. I'll give you a couple of websites. You can go to mine, which is just www.brianoleary.com, Brian with an I, and then that will get you to all these other websites. But Montes Sueños, which is Spanish for Mountain Dreams, is a complex of buildings totaling about 6,000 square feet that Meredith and I have been building for the last 3.5 years. And we're going to be opening our doors for retreats and conferences. One of the first ones is called Waking the Phoenix, which is wakingthephoenix.org. It's a gathering of visionaries, mostly elders from all over the world, who have all sorts of ideas, including ideas in natural health, ideas of social organization, ideas in energy, in peacemaking, in facilitating groups. We're all going to come together in May of this year to have our inaugural conference. And because of the incredible beauty of where we are and the kind of ambiance of the facilities that we've created, which is unique, they chose us over many world-class retreat centers. And so this is the first of many, many kinds of retreats we're going to have here, whose purpose is to discuss and focus on these pressing issues, and to go deeper, to go beyond even beyond the fact that new energy exists or natural healing exists, to go beyond it and talk about, well, how do we implement it? And how can we gain the political power to make that so?
Uh-huh.
And some of that involves, unfortunately, conflict. And, you know, you can't get around that. It would be nice in the best of all worlds in a true democracy, and the United States has ceased becoming a democracy.
Sure.
It's gone the other way. So that you're not going to be able to get a consensus about this right away. But certainly you can get together with kindred spirits, fellow visionaries, who are open to breakthrough solutions, going beyond the box of conventional thinking, to come together and find ways of making these transformations. And I feel that if we can help create that and participate in that process over the coming years, then this is my legacy.
Well, this is poised to become a real knowledge center, a think tank location almost, but in a more organic sense, not so
exactly.
Not like a government-funded think tank, but...
Oh, no. In fact, most of the this Awakening the Phoenix is people are coming at their own expense. We're putting them up at no expense or no profit for us, because I feel that these kinds of conferences are that important.
Well, and as you will allow me, I'll continue to cover these conferences from a news perspective for those people on the internet who want to stay informed about what's happening here.
Well, I thank you, Mike, for your support of this, because we need all the help we can get, and by we I mean all of us, to come together and to understand with mutual respect where we're coming from and some of the ideas we can contribute to the larger picture. And so we who are the visionaries and the organic growers need to all come together and in a very sacred gathering process, and to really then now converge into solutions, because right now the Earth is getting so destroyed so fast. I look over towards the east at the Andes from where we sit, and just over the ridge of the Andes are cloud forests. So just over there is the Amazon basin, which has approximately 400 inches of rain a year just over the ridge.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rainiest part of the basin. And as we speak, as I snap my finger, every second another acre of Amazon rainforest is irretrievably gone. And that is a crime of
yes.
major proportion. It's like war. It's like the war in Iraq. A major crime against humanity and nature. And I, for one, will not tolerate that, and cannot, that kind of action.
Yes. It seems that Western society, which is most strongly identified with the United States of America, but not limited to it, but Western society is destroying itself, and it wants to take as much of the world with it as possible as it implodes. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Western society is headed for a collapse and then a rebirth? Do you think it will stumble along with its current problems for many more decades? What do you think is going to happen?
I really don't know. I do know the collapse is inevitable.
Yeah.
It's because it's happening in many fronts. It's happening economically. It's happening ecologically. It's happening through the practice of war and genocide. There do seem to be very greedy, powerful forces behind those practices. And so the collapse, as far as I'm concerned, is inevitable. And I think the scenario is that those that want to dominate want to get rid of the world, of much of its population, the vast unwashed, the riffraff, which is... now almost everybody but them on the planet. And so they have to let go of their power. We have to create a situation where they let go of their power. And since we, by meaning the rest of us, 99.9% of the world's population, in order to prevail, we need all the help we can get. And where that's coming from, well, some of it's a spiritual process, obviously, prayer, combined intention, because they work. And if people outside of the forces of greed can organize to the extent that there truly is, and not some kind of new age guru that has followers, and but it has to be authentic, and it has to involve everybody. There have to be alliances that we would never have dreamt could happen before. And world democracy needs to really work. And then I think there's hope. And we have to do something. We know the collapse is coming. The rebirth is something that could happen if we consciously apply ourselves toward that happening.
Right. And that's, and again, what you're doing here and who you're inviting to be here is all part of that process, to ask these questions. How would we rebuild social structures? How would we rebuild science and energy and all these things? I mean, you're talking about the next society, really.
That's right. And no one of us, or even some of us, and by that I mean people like you and me and various others that are really interested in doing this kind of work, we don't have all the answers. No one of us has all the answers.
Right.
And there needs to be a new kind of humility.
Yes.
For all of us, because right now there's an arrogance that seems to be happening. There's a revolution coming. I know that the conditions for a political revolution, maybe even a violent one, are all in place, and whether we like it or not. And this gets people very unglued and angry, or wanting to jump to conclusions. And we've seen that even here in this very peaceful Shangri-La. Some gringo folks will come in, and they're very, as we talked about this before, Mike, extremes. Some people are very arrogant, and they're really stuck in their egos and into their power trips and into making money and blah, 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 blah. But then there are many of us that come here who are very much into a natural existence and into truly seeking solutions and coming together as cells, as communities, locally, but as well interconnecting globally. And so I think it's going to be a blend of the internet, a blend of local communities, people learning more to rely on their local food, their local energy, not to be so greedy about using energy. One of the beauties of this place, of course, is we don't need to heat or cool.
Yes, that saves about 70% of your energy usage right there.
And we don't really need electricity. And yeah, when I try to organize something and do business, I really love to have the internet working, but it doesn't always work here, and I get frustrated. And the telephone doesn't always work. But, you know, I think actually, in a sense, if I don't take on projects that are too big and I just kind of slow down a little bit, the good stuff all happens. It may be longer periods of time, but in a sense, I think we, you and I, Mike, are trying out a new lifestyle in this new environment, which we find very harmonious, even though we have these struggles. Some of them have to do with just getting settled, or not having all of the conveniences that people normally have.
Well, Western society, I mean, the cities in the U.S., at least in my experience, yeah, sure, there are many things that are convenient, but so much of it is false. Mm-hmm. There's not a square meter of natural landscape left. Mm-hmm. All the waterways have been turned to concrete. The river can't flow naturally anymore. They've all been dammed. The natural cycles are gone, and you know, I know you're fully aware of this, but how it's so important to live in the natural cycles with nature, because if you don't, you get psychotic, depressed, cancer, all these other things.
Yes, and we notice that whenever we go back to the States. We've been here 3.5 years. We may have taken 10 trips there, 2 to Europe, 1 to Asia, within the past 3.5 years. And in every case, we're absolutely dumbfounded and struck by the incredible pollution and craziness and tenseness and hurriedness of each of these each of these trips. And I'm more and more reluctant to take them. I think that the revolution, as they say, the revolution, you won't see it on television, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But you may not see it in the U.S. either until the people really awaken and they really begin to see what's happening for what it is, to look at the big picture.
I'm glad you used that word. I also think it is an awakening that must happen. And there are so many barriers to that right now in the United States. For example, did you know that 50% of the adult population is now on at least one pharmaceutical?
Wow.
50%. And most of these pharmaceuticals alter cognitive function. They alter perception. They reduce awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a situation where many people are sleepwalking through life.
Yes.
And they're earning the paycheck, they're paying their taxes, they're consuming, but they're not awakened.
Yeah, I was just amazed to see some of the places where I used to live. We've Meredith and I each, we've been together now 16 years, but even before we were together and since we've been together, we've lived in many, many different places. And to see the deterioration, and even though it's gradual, like it's like the frog in the pot of water that's gradually raised to boiling until the frog can't get out.
Yes.
That seems to be what's happening now there, and it's amazing. Like, just, well, my children, they're 40-ish, they're both 40-ish, and they live in Princeton, New Jersey, and I was on the faculty there and lived there back in the 70s, and even since the 70s, my God, the strip malls, the malls, the Phoenix. I lived in Phoenix, Arizona, back in the 80s. But even going way, way back when I was a child growing up in Boston in the 40s, the changes are absolutely incredible and not good. And then we come here, and it's like going back to my childhood of like going to New Hampshire to the White Mountains or the lakes, and it back into nature, and the worst things can happen, like when you arrived here earlier. Well, I was on edge about internet and emailing, and people were wanting me to answers, and they wondered why they weren't getting answers because the service didn't work for a few days, and I found myself temporarily getting caught up in the old and not taking the deep breath we all need to be taking.
Yes. Well, I want to respect your time here and conclude this particular interview and ask you if you have any final thoughts that you want to share before we wrap this one up, and also invite you that we can do this again sometime in the future.
Okay, Mike. Well, thanks. I really enjoyed this interview. It's very perceptive. We get into the meat of the matter. Websites are always the best way to kind of keep following what's going on here, and I post my essays and have a many multifaceted web suite of websites, and it's simply brianoleary.com. There's also Montesueños, which is MontesueNos.org, which is our retreat center, and you can check into that and see schedules of workshops and retreats, which we're going to be having here. And we encourage people to come down here and either take a workshop or just come and visit and see what's going on here. Because in our way of thinking, this is we're not going to travel as much. My carbon footprint has been enough in taking all these flights, and so we're probably not going anywhere for a long time. Except to develop this place using ecological means. And also, I've written many books. Most recent is called Reinheriting the Earth, which is generally available in the States and or wherever. And there's a website where you can order that as well, which is linked to brianoleary.com.
I really want to thank you for being so willing to share your ideas in such a forthright way. I mean, I think this is so crucial to us, and I mean the community, us finding solutions. We cannot hold back on the things that need to be stated. We can't operate with, you know, political correctness, and we're not going to offend somebody. We need to offend a few institutions out there and tell the truth say we got to make some changes here, we're not going to make it as a society.
Absolutely. You couldn't be more correct. We have to be now willing to have the courage to break free of the straitjacket that we've all been in. And part of my teaching is to help make it safe for people to break out of their box. I mean, I went through this process myself, and it was more slowly, if anything, than I could have or should have. But I did do it in the end. And so there is this period of transition, of decompression from the mainstream, of having the courage to stand up to those who are giving you the security and career perks that most people are kind of addicted to. And
yes,
people are going to maybe learn the hard way. It may be imposed on them. It already is through all the house foreclosures and highly educated people not being able to get jobs and being trained to get jobs. And, well, maybe that's not absolutely necessary. A person could go somewhere like here. We sure don't want too many people here in this lovely village, or we don't want it to be another San Fernando Valley, but there are places on earth where people can go and start new, and you don't need the career, you don't need the salary, you can live quite well elsewhere.
And I'll add to that by saying where you don't need to define yourself by what others think of you.
Yes.
And
amen to that. And I was brought up that way. I mean, I had a dad who was pull yourself up by the bootstraps. If you don't get all A's, you'll be a shoe salesman, this kind of threat. And so the first 30 years or so of my life, I was a super achiever and a conformist. And then another 10 to 15 years, I was itching to get out of that, but afraid to do it because I was afraid of losing my career security. So I kind of stood in the middle and kind of slowly and secretly got into the new. But it's only over the past 20 years have I felt truly free.
Well, it's amazing. When you start to actually explore the boundaries of the box that society wants you to be in, you find all your peers and colleagues and friends and family members start shouting at you, "Don't you dare step outside the box." And so if there's anything I want the listeners to hear here is, please have the courage to step outside the box. If you haven't already, most people listening to this, by the way, Brian, they're already well outside that box.
Oh, good.
they're not even in the box.
Good, great. Like, that's fantastic. So and I think the other thing, good, I'm glad your listeners, your readers are in that category. The welcoming thing is that on the other side of the great divide, namely the boundaries of the box, are new colleagues.
Yeah, indeed. You find all kinds of new support and new confirmations there. Well, thank you again for your time. And I'll give your website one more time. That's www.BrianO'Leary, and that's O'Leary without the
apostrophe,
because you can't put that in a URL.
Yeah.
So it's BrianO'Leary.com, and Brian with an I. And this has been Mike Adams here, Health Ranger for NaturalNews.com with Brian O'Leary, reporting from an incredible scene high in the Andes Mountains in southern Ecuador. And I hope some of you hearing this get a chance to come visit and participate in these conferences here at Monte Sueños someday. So look into that. Maybe I'll see you here someday. Take care.